It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song.
In the center of our service, in the center of our lives, let us make room for quiet, for centering, and for prayer. We may use these first moments to light candles of memory and hope, or just sit quietly remembering who you are and why you are here. I've taken an Atonement Day prayer written by Chaim Stern. Once more, Atonement Day has come, all pretense gone, naked heart revealed to the hiding self. We stand on holy ground between the day that was and the one that must be. We tremble. At what did we aim? How did we stumble? What did we take? What did we give? To what were we blind? Last year's confession came so easily to the lips. Will this year's come from deeper than the skin? Say then, why are our paths strewn with promises like fallen leaves? Say then, when shall our lust be for wisdom? Say now, love and truth shall meet, justice and peace shall embrace. This we vow, this we vow. Amen.
Some people listen to a sermon wondering what kind of a trip this is going to be, whether there will be anything honest or useful, whether it will be what you expect, or whether it will be something in 7-8 time or 7-4 time, like the last hymn. This morning, I want to take you on a trip to the very heart of almost all religions, all philosophies, and all psychologies. It begins with the idea of atonement, which most of us know is the center of the Jewish festival of the Days of Atonement and Yom Kippur. But the idea is no more particularly Jewish than it is Hindu or Muslim or anything else. The idea is at the center of every spiritual or personal path, by whatever name, though each one has its own ideas about how to do it. Now, this isn't meant as an exercise borrowing a concept from Judaism that then goes through all world religions, isn't meant as an exercise in learning toleration for other faiths. I'm not very inspired by the idea of learning tolerance. I don't think it's a very high aspiration. Too often we strive only for toleration of other religions, which means that we also have the power at our whim to decide not to tolerate them. We strive only for toleration of other religions that we neither understand nor really respect, which is a pretty low aim. If someone tells me they are a Mormon, and what I really think to myself is, how on earth could anyone believe Joseph Smith's fantasies or that weird Mormon idea that after death you all get to populate your own planet? If that's what I think, but I say to them, well, that's a great religion. I've lied to them. I've turned a conversational possibility into a triviality. And I've furthered the cause of worldwide ignorance, which doesn't need any more furthering than it's already getting. I'm pretending to tolerate their belief, though I neither understand nor respect it, because I've learned that's what I'm supposed to do. And then if I tell this Mormon that I think of myself as a religious person, though I've really never found the concept of God very interesting, and they say, well, to each his own, I suspect they're lying to me too, because they think my belief is crazy at best, and they don't respect it a bit. When we say to somebody else, oh, whatever you believe is just fine, I respect all beliefs, we're doing several things, and they're all bad. We're writing each other moral blank checks by saying we don't think anything really matters beyond personal whims and habits. I think that's harmful nonsense. Some things really matter, and we need to be trying to find them and articulate them and serve them. And I think every religion has a piece of this truth, and no religion has it all. Now, most religious poetry that we read or sing is written about seeking or striving for something that people haven't found yet. But some religious poets have found it. And they write from the other side, so to speak, or from the center. These are the poets that I want to use this morning. I want to read to you from poets who have found it from many different traditions and see if you can't feel what they found. What I hope you'll hear is a voice that transcends both religions and gods, the voice that comes from the place within us, from the place in our mind and our soul that has given birth to all the gods of history. The responsive reading this morning was an example of this from Kabir, a 15th century musician and poet whose religion crossed several confessional boundaries and is very hard to categorize. He was a Hindu, raised in a Muslim society, whose writings are significant scriptural references and inspirational references in Hinduism, Islam, and the Sikh religion. His God, you could say, was the God of the Hebrew scriptures as understood by Muhammad and enlarged by his own Hindu tradition. He wasn't tolerating these different religions. He was connecting them by seeing what they were looking for and speaking from within that center. That's what I mean by going beyond God. Here's another religious poem that Kabir wrote. He wrote some wonderful stuff. Are you looking for me? I'm in the next seat. My shoulder is against yours. You won't find me in temples, not in Indian shrine rooms, nor in synagogues, nor in cathedrals, not in masses, nor churches, nor in eating nothing but vegetables. When you really look for me, you will see me instantly. You will find me in the tiniest house of time. Kabir says, student, tell me, what is God? He is the breath inside the breath. Like most spiritual masters and poets, you'll notice, and I think it's important to notice, Kabir is not offering an argument. He isn't trying to persuade you. He's simply speaking what he knows to be true, and then he stops. And the fact that he stops shows that he has faith that when the time is right and when you are ready, you may find that song singing in the key of your own life and may find your own way to that center. This search for connection always assumes that everything we need is already here. That's one of the things that's so healthy about it. It assumes that we're living in a world of spiritual riches that are abundant and sufficient. And this is true regardless of the religion or the culture or the century or anything. Here's a paragraph from the Jewish writer, Philo of Alexandria, writing in the first century. God loves to give and freely bestows good things on all people, even the imperfect, inviting them to participate in virtue and to love it, and at the same time manifesting his superabundant wealth, which is more than enough for as many as wish to profit from it. He shows this in nature as well. For when he sends rain on the ocean and causes springs to gush in the most desolate wastelands and makes sterile soil blossom with grass and flowers, what is he showing but the extravagance of his wealth and goodness? Now, you'll start learning this melody. All these will start sounding like variations on the same song. Here's some lines from Jesus saying the same kind of thing. See if you don't hear the melody. Ask and you shall receive, seek and you will find, knock and the door will be opened to you, for everyone who asks receives, and he who seeks finds, and to him who knocks the door will be opened. All of these poems are poems about the quest for atonement. I love that word, and one reason I love the word atonement is because it's the only English word that became an important theological concept. I don't know what the Hebrew word was, but that's not what's known as the concept. It's the English word, atonement. Another reason I love that word is because it's the only complex word I know whose meaning is contained in the spelling of the word. If you divide the word into its syllables, it says at-one-ment, and that's what it means, at-one-ment. And the third reason I love the word is because it's the central goal of every religion, at-one-ment, being at one with what feels most life-giving, most sacred, most profound, most commanding. Each religion has a different formula for how to do this, so does each philosophy, each psychology, but the goal is always much the same. I have another free association with this word, at-one-ment, that comes to my mind for reasons only my neurophysiologist might know. It comes from somewhere beyond the fringes. The word reminds me of one of the comedian W.C. Fields' funniest and saddest lines. If you don't know who he was a very funny and very cynical comic of the first half of the 20th century. He had a very distinctive voice, and everyone loves to try it, including me, and no one can do it well, including me. And he said, and became famous for saying, some really outrageous things, like, any man who hates dogs and children can't be all bad. Fields was the second most famous funny man of his time. And that was a fact that tormented him his whole life. The most famous was Charlie Chaplin, and Fields never got over it. It's odd to think of that amount of insecurity that near the top, but it's there. Once during an interview, the interviewer asked him about Charlie Chaplin. As I remember it, Fields replied, "He's numero uno, numero uno. And all the world loves numero uno. People only count to one, you know." "I'm numero two-o." "And nobody loves numero two-o." Because of that line, I can't think of at-one-ment without... See? Now it's got into you. Thinking of at-two-ment. And nobody loves at-two-ment either. You never hear anyone writing songs about it or chasing after it. Everyone wants a feeling of at-one-ment, but nobody wants to feel that they're in a state of attunement with God, with anything sacred to them, with their beloved. And a lot of time, it isn't even that good. A lot of time, we don't do much better than being in attunement or atmeniment, with our spirit and our life energy just dissipated into a dozen different directions, few of which cherish us or nourish us. Almost every one of the world's mysticisms speaks of our spiritual challenge as going from attunement to at-one-ment. They speak of going from dualism, where we feel that we're separate from God, from what matters, that facts and values have become divorced, that life and meaning have become divorced, dualism, to a state of unity and identity where everything is at one. We're going from attunement to at-one-ment. This isn't the only message in the world's religions, but it's an essential part of all of them, whether it survives as an orthodoxy or as a heresy. And I want to share some lines from a variety of spiritually musical writers who sang this song, so you can learn the song and learn to sing it yourself. Muhammad once said, "Whoever knows himself knows God." That's at-one-ment. Another line in the Quran says that God is closer to us than our own jugular vein. It's a way of saying you're already in a state of at-one-ment, you just don't know it. A medieval Christian mystic, Meister Eckhart, sang a lot of songs in this key. He said, "The eye with which I see God and the eye with which God sees me is the same eye." That's at-one-ment. It's a wonderful line. He said, "God became man so that man might become God." He said, "The birth of Jesus does me no good at all unless he is born in me." He's claiming an identity with God. That's at-one-ment. In most Western religions, that's been regarded as heresy. And Meister Eckhart was regarded as a heretic in his day. Now he's revered. But whether it's orthodoxy or heresy, it's healthier and better for you than an orthodoxy that defines you as coming from original sin. We come from original blessing, and the mystics all know that. Once you recognize this theme of at-one-ment, you'll begin to see it in religious writers everywhere, every culture, every century. You'll spot it. For instance, here's how a 9th century Chinese mystic put it. See if it doesn't sound like the same song. "If you look for the truth outside yourself, it gets farther and farther away. Today, walking alone, I meet him everywhere I step. He is the same as me, yet I am not him. Only if you understand it in this way will you merge with the way things are." Again, notice that these people, any culture, any century, any religion, they're not offering an argument. They're not trying to persuade you. They're simply saying what they know is true, and then they stop. And they stop because they know that when the time is right, when you're ready, you can hear the song in the key of your own life, and you too will sing. That stopping is such a faithful thing for mystics to do. The silence after the stop almost says more than the poem. Here's another from the great Sufi poet Rumi, talking about that kind of awakening, when the song awakens in yourself. "I've lived on the lip of insanity, wanting to know reasons. Knocking on a door, it finally opens, and I discover that I've been knocking from the inside." He was always at one, but he didn't know it. when he was in at Tumut. He was living on the lip of insanity because it's crazy to think that we're separate from God, from the universe, from the heart of love. And when the door opens, we find we were always on the inside and didn't know it. There are a few more lines about at-one-ment from medieval Christian mystic Mechtilde of Magdeburg. She says, "Each creature God made must live in its own true nature. How could I resist my nature that lives for oneness with God?" Same song. This is such nice poetry, it's hard to stop. Just two more, both from the 17th century Christian mystic Angelus Silesius. "If in your heart you make a manger for his birth, then God will once again become a child on earth." And this may be one of my favorites. "God, whose love and joy are present everywhere, can't come to visit you unless you aren't there." Most of the people who write about this are in religious traditions. Of course, it isn't restricted to that. It's a kind of awakening to the fact that we're part of something much bigger, much more whole, much more gracious. I've known scientists who came to that feeling through the study of their sciences, naturalists who came to it through an appreciation of nature. It's everywhere. The Jewish concept of at-one-ment has an ethical and a social dimension to it that says we can't get right with God without first getting right with our neighbors and our community and all the people that we may have harmed, whether we meant to or not. But I think this ethical dimension is part of every one of these, because a tree is known by its fruits, as Jesus said. The proof is in the pudding, as I don't know who said. Maybe W.C. Fields. And it's always the case that if we want to know what someone believes, we don't have to ask them. Just watch them. Someone pretending to have found enlightenment who is so narcissistic that she sucks the oxygen out of the air around you is too full of herself to be full at all. Like that last poem, "God can't come to visit you unless you aren't there, filling up all the space yourself." What a wonderful insight. A lot of this is part of the suspicion and the curiosity and the hope that have been aroused again by this book, The Da Vinci Code. Part of what that book has aroused is this deep suspicion that religions lie, that what's being taught doesn't give us a sense of at-oneness, it gives us a sense of distance, of at-two-ness, of dissipation, that something sacred is being violated and we're being cheated. And in real life, a lot of people don't feel like they have it together. They feel beside themselves in a state of at-tument, and nobody loves that, or fragmentation. Poetry aside, our experiences in life often teach us that many times we ask and we don't receive. We seek and we don't find. We knock and no useful door is opened. Part of the reason to come to a church, any church, is wondering if maybe this time we'll receive something, find something, some door will open, at least a crack. So we come to a church which is supposed to be one way to find this at-one-ment stuff. And then we spend a few weeks listening, sitting there passively, saying, "All right, when's it going to happen? When does the gift come?" And we don't feel our hearts strangely warmed, and so we go away and we're disappointed again. The truth is, a sermon really can't do this. There's so much more to it. You need to stay. You need to come regularly. You have to make a decision to get involved in a community. You have to make friends. You have to take the effort to know somebody and to be known, to let the positive atmosphere in a place like this get inside of you and stir you up and change your tuning to a more positive key. You need to prepare your mind and your soul to receive the message you wish you could hear, to learn the song you need to sing. Usually takes regular involvement in a community where spiritual values are cherished, not just a handful of sermons. The truth is, there isn't much that a preacher can really do, especially when talking about a subject like this one. We just say what we know is true, then we stop. And you know the rest.